Mr. President, may I inquire the senator from the 10th?
Senator from the 10th, do you yield to inquiry?
I do.
Proceed.
You know, Senator, it occurred to me, not unlike the signs that baseball managers and teams have and pitchers and catchers, we should come up with some, like, hand signal thing. Oh, that, yeah. No, I was trying to get your attention, not because I wanted to interfere with what you were doing, because I wasn't listening intently to what you're doing.
You were or were not listening intently?
I was, actually.
Oh, well, I'm honored. Yeah. And pleasantly surprised.
Unlike, normally when we're in debate, you can't hear a word that's going on because there's so much noise. I don't know if you've noticed this morning, but this is about the quietest this chamber has been this session.
You know,
I mean, it is really, I can finally hear what's happening on the floor.
And I'm not going to employ sharper practices here, but I will note that part of the reason this chamber might be as quiet as it's been all session is because I think there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of us in here.
Exactly.
But that said, as much as I appreciate and respect the other 27 members of this body, I am not going to suggest that we need to see another dozen of them here anytime.
Exactly.
I realize people are working on important matters in their offices.
I know it's a very busy day in the Capitol, too. I know that there are several groups in town from all over the state for their advocacy days. My office has been Grand Central Station today.
Yeah.
No, I just...
Senator from Barrie, please observe the line of debate.
Close call. The reason that I was signaling is I wasn't sure what this debate, what direction it was going to take over the course of the day. And one of the things that I heard you and the Senator from Barrie talking about was your belief that one of the things we should be focusing on in this state is a discussion about how to reduce the number of abortions.
Right.
And one of the things that I think would go a long way to doing that is by starting to have frank conversations about medically accurate, comprehensive sex education. And so I wanted the opportunity to stand up and offer an amendment and then maybe inquire of you after that so that we could get this amendment kind of out there, moving, that sort of thing. And just wanted to see if you'd be interested in letting me offer my amendment.
No, I would be happy to, and frankly, I could seize upon the opportunity to step outside for just a minute myself anyway. So why don't we break off the inquiry? We'll let you get your amendment to the floor, and I will be back momentarily.
Thank you. Mr. President.
What reason do you stand?
I have an amendment. Mr. President, my amendment has been distributed, so I would request a waiver of its reading.
Send your amendment forward. Seeing no objection, a waiver will be granted. Would you like to explain your amendment?
Yes, Mr. President, I would move for the adoption of this amendment. Mr. President, this amendment is essentially a bill that I have sponsored in the past. I actually have not filed it this year, but this is identical to a bill that I've filed the past few years. And this addresses the issue, Mr. President, of comprehensive sex education in our schools. Now, I know at first blush this is something where we're talking about a very specific issue as it relates to access to abortion services right now, which is the waiting period. But one of the reasons that I think that everybody agrees that this underlying bill has been pushed forward is because folks would like to see women be able to make these decisions with as much information as possible. And I believe that one of the things that we should be doing before a woman even finds herself having to make this difficult decision in front of her is to talk about, in a very open way, comprehensive, medically accurate sex education in the state of Missouri. So this bill, or this amendment that I have circulated, does the following things. First of all, it basically states that any course materials and instructions relating to human sexuality and sexually transmitted diseases shall be medically and factually accurate, which is actually already the law in the state of Missouri, and that they must be based on peer-reviewed projects that have been demonstrated to influence healthy behavior and to be age-appropriate. That language is important to me because I want to make sure that we are using the latest information when we are talking to people in the state of Missouri, especially our young folks. I want to make sure that we're speaking in an age-appropriate manner, and I want to make sure that we are using the latest peer-reviewed scientific evidence when it comes to this issue. I do believe that we should present education relating to abstinence in the state of Missouri. I think it's incredibly important. But in addition to that, I want to make sure that we are also talking about other reliable forms of birth control, because while abstinence is the message that we should be giving to our students and our children across the state, we know that abstinence isn't being practiced by kids. It hasn't since the beginning of time. We need to tell people what happens when you don't practice abstinence. We need to be talking about contraception. We need to be talking about sexually transmitted diseases. There was a long time when sexually transmitted diseases, unfortunately, Kansas City and St. Louis were two of the highest incidents of sexually transmitted diseases in the nation. And I think that's something that we should all try to curb, frankly. I'm not sure that that's something I want to be known as number one or number two for. So I would argue that it is time for us to start having frank conversations about ways to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. I also put in some of the latest information to let people know about communication between parents and children regarding sexuality, and then also talking to students, frankly, in an age-appropriate way, about those ways that we can prevent pregnancies and that we can prevent sexually transmitted diseases. When we add those things, in my opinion, we will reduce the number of unplanned pregnancies in the state of Missouri, and that will automatically reduce the number of abortions. With that, Mr. President, I would move for adoption of my amendment, and I would ask Mr. President to inquire of the senator from the 1st.
Senator from the 1st, do you yield inquiry to the senator from the 10th?
I do.
Proceed.
Thanks, Senator. One of the conversations that I heard you and the senator from Barry having were both of your desire to reduce the number of abortions in the state of Missouri. You know, one of the things that happens when we have conversations about this medical procedure is that people get labeled automatically as either pro-life or pro-choice.
Right.
And I'm starting to get increasingly frustrated with those labels, because I don't think that those labels accurately describe how the majority of Missourians or Americans feel about this procedure.
And I think there's empirical data to back you up on that observation.
In my opinion, just because someone is pro-choice doesn't mean that they are pro-abortion. Just because someone is pro-life doesn't mean that they are anti-choice. I just think there is a whole spectrum of the way people feel, and at the end of the day, this is an issue that is intensely private.
Yes.
For the individual woman who's having to make this decision. And the frustration that I have had is our attempt as politicians and as government to try to interfere with a decision that should be made between a woman, her family, if she has a faith community with that community, and then obviously with her doctor and healthcare
right.
providers. I really don't like it when people try to put themselves in the shoes of someone who's going through this, because I think it's absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
There is no way for me to lay out every single factor that a woman is going through when she makes this decision. And one of the concerns that I have about this piece of legislation is the 72-hour is tripling our current consent law.
Right.
And, you know, our consent law in the state of Missouri, I've been told by those who do label themselves as pro-life, and frankly, those who label themselves as pro-choice say that it's one of the strictest in the nation already, our consent laws. And
right.
frankly, I think the current consent law was passed while I was here in the legislature. So I remember, I mean, the requirements that we put now on our abortion providers to what they have to say, how they have to say it, when they have to say it, it's some of the strictest in the nation.
Well, and I think that collectively, people don't want more regulation and more restriction. They want more policies geared toward attacking the underlying concern and limiting the number of abortions and attacking the circumstances that out of which abortions arise. I think people want us focusing on promoting abstinence, focusing on promoting contraception, including the subject matter of your amendment, which is comprehensive, medically accurate sex education that is age-appropriate. I think people want us promoting adoption and other alternatives to abortion. And I think that is the discussion that we should be having, as opposed to, for the people that do make that choice, how to make it harder and more burdensome to exercise that right. But I have to say, your amendment gets into some very good and important issues. including teaching children about the danger of sexual predators, which I think is critical. Sexually transmitted diseases, which, as you point out, is something that certain regions in our state, including the one that you hail from and the one that I represent, maybe leading the league in things you don't want to lead the league in. Online safety and responsible text messaging, and that's another whole issue that includes sex education. I mean, and it gets into some of the statutes we have now. You know, some things that kids text can mark them for life under our current laws.
Yes.
And we need to do what we can to educate them. It's a technology that didn't exist until recently, and I agree with you. I think that our statutes and our sex education practices need to catch up to the times in that regard, and I think that's an appropriate
Absolutely.
Thing to put in statute.
And I'm just not sure that those conversations are happening. I mean, children and teens experimenting with their sexuality has always happened. With the advent of technology that is available now, it's completely changed things. You know, I had a case appointed to us at our law firm this year where I had a 13-year-old boy, two 13-year-old boys, a 13-year-old girl, all charged with a long list of creating child pornography, distributing child pornography, the list kind of went, and enticing a child to participate, all of these things because of what would have been years ago, innocent, not age appropriate, but, experimentation, and then being photographed and sent around, and then all of a sudden all of these children are charged with, frankly, delinquency charges that could follow them for the rest of their lives. And I think it's important that we start having a conversation about making sure that folks know what this means to them.
I think it's hard to argue against education on that issue and on all of these issues. In many ways, I think education is our best line of defense for all of the concerns that we're here today talking about, whether it's limiting the number of abortions that occur in our state through education and alternatives, whether it's stopping the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, or in the example you just gave, protecting 12 and 13-year-olds who may not know any better from doing things that violate very important laws in our state.
Right.
In a way that that I don't know, I mean, through a technological means that I don't know our statutes. Certainly were not in the mind when our statutes were adopted because the technology didn't exist at that time. And I'm not saying that certainly doesn't excuse it. It's a terrible thing. But kids need to be educated about responsible texting. I strongly agree.
I heard you discussing with the senator from Barry that your constituents kind of have a really diverse point of view on this particular issue.
There are many sharply held opposing viewpoints on this issue in my district, and I would say perhaps more so than in many districts in the state. People feel strongly on both sides of it where I'm from.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think every one of us has a district that is really unique when it comes to this issue. But I think that if you were to strip off the labels, if you were to strip out the politics, that most Missourians would probably be actually all in line on what they feel about this safe and legal procedure. Most people feel like that it's not something that they hope they ever have to face hope they never have to face making that decision to begin with.
Right.
But one of the things that's frustrating to me about this particular bill is it seems to me to indicate that a woman who presents herself at a facility in order to have this procedure, that she hasn't already spent a significant amount of time considering what led her to this decision in the first place. And so, we've got this interesting situation where, you have a woman who may have been, contemplating this for a long time. She makes her decision based on all of the facts. She goes in. She already has the 24-hour waiting period. after everything has been presented to her, and then frankly everything else that she goes through, Senator, because you know a lot of times the thing that's frustrating to me is that a woman can't even access sometimes the facilities without having to go through a gauntlet of individuals who are frankly pretty mean-spirited in judging her for what she's about to do. Now, I understand the intensely personal beliefs that, that the folks who are outside a facility have.
And they have First Amendment rights.
Absolutely. And I will just as vehemently defend those First Amendment rights on this floor as I will to defend this right that we're talking about here today.
Sure.
That being said, it seems to me that there is this culture that is trying to shame a woman from making a decision that is her decision to make. And to continue to push it back, to me, starts to interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. And one of the problems that I've had with the specific abortion regulations that we've put on in this state since I've been in the legislature is this increasing attempt to interfere with doctor-patient relationships. And we don't do that with any other medical procedure at all. Nothing.
Right.
That I'm aware of. We, as legislators, do not tell doctors specifically what information has to be in their informed consent for any other procedure, but we do it for this one.
Well, and we also don't require a 72 or a 24-hour waiting period on any other surgical procedure that I'm aware of. I'm confident the senator from Buchanan is in the chamber. I'm, as a member of the medical profession, I'm confident that if I'm wrong about that, he'll correct me. But as I stand here, I certainly don't know of one. I share your concern about that.
And so I guess the fact that we are, yet again saying, okay, well now, even though this woman has already been told by the Missouri legislature what she has to hear prior to making the decision, and she has to wait the 24 hours. Now we are going to say it's 72 hours. And all the evidence that I've seen, Senator, is that the longer you wait to have an abortion, that's when the risks start to increase. And so I don't see any reason to do that to a woman, to interfere at that level.
Well, and let's face it, this 72-hour requirement in the underlying bill, I may stand corrected. There may be a carve-out in the bill that I haven't seen, but do you see in the underlying bill where there's any – is there a carve-out for life, health, or safety of the woman from the 72-hour waiting period? I mean, and how does that stand now? I mean, if there's a medical emergency, is there still a 24-hour waiting period under Missouri law? As I stand here, I'm not certain of that.
I feel like right now, and I'm not confident, but I feel like right now if there is a true medical emergency – and a woman's life is in danger, that you do not have to wait the 24 hours. I think that that's correct. It has been so many years, Senator, since we debated the current consent law that I can't remember, but I specifically remember us having that discussion, and I can't imagine that anyone would have required us to wait 24 hours if there was a woman on an operating table who was getting ready to die.
Well, that said, I am looking through bill, and I am not seeing language to that effect. I share your sense that that must be the case, or I'm not sure the law would still be on the books.
I will tell you this, though. If it is not the case, and we are extending it from 24 to 72 hours, then that is an amendment we're going to need to have drafted.
That
because,
is a real issue. Yeah. Well, this is all a real issue, but that's a real problem.
That is a significant problem. I guess you know what? What I'm going to suggest that we do is that we just not allow the discussion on this issue to close until we have addressed that issue.
You know, and it's up to you if you want to take, I mean, that may be a separate amendment relative to this one.
Yeah, absolutely it will be, and it's something that we can, you know, get to eventually, and we'll get there. I wanted to start this conversation by talking about kind of, to me, the bigger issue. If we want to reduce abortions in the state of Missouri, we need to reduce unplanned pregnancies.
You know, I see a gentleman with two or three white hairs standing next to you. and very striking and dashing and handsome fellow who I am privileged to serve with in the body.
The Silver Fox.
Well, I wasn't sure if he was trying to get your attention for just a moment.
He did.
While
he told
I am
me,
droning on into the microphone to try to give you the opportunity to have that conversation.
I appreciate that. You know, I was just talking to some of the doormen over here about at times I'm happy that this is not available via video to the public because, you know, it just I don't know that individuals would want to see this. At other times, I kind of wish that it was available because if they're just listening to the audio and they hear sort of this dragging out of the conversation, they don't know why it's happening, and it'd be nice if they could have the visual to go with it. While you were talking just now, the senator from Barry told me that it was his belief that you can suspend suspend the 24-hour notice if there is a second opinion that the woman is in a true medical emergency. I'm going to have to look at that before I, you know, trust but verify, they say.
Sure. Well, no, that's right. As a former president indicated or stated. That said, I will tell you I have some concern about, I hate to say it, but if you're talking about a medical emergency threatening the life of the woman, two opinions seem, and again, maybe there's there's litigation that has determined this, maybe a second opinion is not an undue burden, but when you're talking about a medical emergency that could claim one life or two, it seems like a second opinion might be a greater burden than we need to impose. That said, if it's on the books and it's been litigated and the courts have spoken on that, they have spoken on that. That doesn't necessarily mean it's good policy, though. Just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's a good idea.
I have some late-breaking information here from the excellent Chris Shappy. Jim Ertle, now embarrassed, but, you know... you should have taken that credit, Chris. High five. All right. So I actually have the current law now.
Good place to start.
Yes. Except in the case of medical emergency, no person shall perform or induce an abortion unless at least 24 hours prior thereto, the physician who is to perform or induce the abortion or a qualified professional has conferred with the patient and discussed with her, and then it kind of lists everything out. At the very end of it, it says only one such conference shall be required for each abortion. So it does say that except in the case of medical emergency.
One opinion, not two.
Right.
What section of the statute is that, if that happens to be on the page you've got?
We are on page 12 of the floor sub. It's section 188.039.
You know, I was leafing through it, and now I'm looking at your amendment. That might be part of my problem. Page 12 of the floor sub, which would be almost at the end of it, and that's lines 9 through 23 on page 12.
Yes.
Got it. So, and do we talk about what a medical emergency is, or is that essentially what the consulting physician says it is?
That's going to be a new question that I would have to have answered. Right now, I do not know how medical emergency is defined under...
Sure.
State law. I know that there's been an attempt over the years to change that. I think there may be even some bills that have been filed this year that address that issue, but I do not know under this specific informed consent law how medical emergency is defined, and I don't see a section relating to definitions. I will tell you that brings up something else that... Well, I've just been told subsection 1, it defines medical emergency.
Subsection 1 of that particular?
Of that particular page? Oh, sure enough. So, for purposes of this section.
Oh, medical emergency. Got it.
Medical
yep.
emergency means a condition which, on the basis of a physician's good faith clinical judgment, so complicates the medical condition of a pregnant woman as to necessitate the immediate abortion of her pregnancy to avert her death, or for which a delay will create a serious risk of substantial and irreversible impairment of a major bodily function.
Well, I think that that's good policy. It could be better policy, but I think that that's good policy.
I do think it is. You know, as I brought up the issue of there may be other bills that have been filed this session that address the issue of medical emergency or others, I wanted to know if you'd had the opportunity. I know that when this early in session, you don't kind of really have an idea of all of the bills that have been filed. But,
well, I was about to ask, actually.
And a lot of times, as we're here in the Senate, we don't, you know, unless you're in a committee that hears a bill, or unless you have a bill on the floor and you're getting prepared for it, you don't know how many other bills have been filed. But I've been told, and this chart is actually 11 days old, but I've been told that as it relates to the issue of abortions in the state of Missouri, we have already filed this session 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, at least 22 bills that have already been filed this session in both chambers that relate to the issue of abortion services, abortion providers, access to this safe and legal procedure. So it's incredibly interesting to me to kind of see all of the different versions that are out there. I didn't count in this list any of the bills that have been filed that address the issue that my amendment addresses. And, you know, one of the things that's frustrating to me is, you know, women are the ones, obviously, that are having to make this decision along with everyone that is a part of their family or medical team or faith community. But one of the things that we never really spend a lot of time talking about, unless we're, you know, talking about, you know, Medicaid expansion, that sort of thing, is just how every time we have a bill about this, even though it's focused strictly on the abortion procedure, but how every one of these bills, in my opinion, erodes access of women to health care in general. For instance, and I'm going to bring up a for instance here. So Planned Parenthood right now in the state of Missouri, I believe, is the only organization that has a clinic that provides abortions. And so because of that, Planned Parenthood has been labeled as this organization that is, you know, horrible. They are, you know, an abortion rights organization. They are, you know, out on the front of this issue. The reality is, Senator, that Planned Parenthood, over 90% of what they do is related to women's health.
Right.
When it comes to cancer screenings, mammograms, sexually transmitted disease, both prevention and treatment, well woman exams, sex education, over 90% of what they do. And I know for a fact that there are women, especially women who are not covered by insurance through their employer or otherwise, their only interaction with a healthcare provider is the interaction that they have at their local Planned Parenthood clinic.
Right.
That's where they are able to get, at a reasonable cost or free if they're eligible, well woman exams, cancer screenings, all of the things that we know they need to have so that we can prevent those future health care costs that we've talked about. If you can catch a cancer early, it is infinitely better on the
right.
woman and her health, but it's also better for those who are having to pay for her treatment.
More cost-effective.
It is so much more cost-effective. And so every time we attack Planned Parenthood because of this one safe and legal procedure that they do perform, we are also attacking all of the good work that they do. And this is access to health care for women that they don't have otherwise. Because in the state of Missouri, as you may be aware, there is a massive gap of people who have access to health care. I mean, well, we probably don't have to tell you that, but, you know, I'm going to tell you anyway.
Sure.
So I know everyone's excited to hear my statistics. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, which is the law of the land that we have not completely bought into yet here in the state of Missouri, you receive coverage, health care coverage, up to 138% of the federal poverty level. Right now, it's my understanding, and I've heard different statistics out here, that we cut off eligibility in the state of Missouri anywhere between 16 and 21% of the federal poverty level.
The difference of almost a quarter of a million Missourians, as I understand it, maybe
massive.
Even more than that, yeah.
It's massive. And the thing that's so frustrating for individuals in Missouri right now who were excited about the Affordable Care Act and their ability to start shopping for new insurance is you're actually not even able to get onto the health care exchange, the federal health care exchange, and start shopping unless you make 100% of the federal poverty level or more. And so there's this gap of folks who don't have Medicaid, who can't shop for affordable care under the Affordable Care Act on the federal exchange, that's somewhere between 21% and 100% of the federal poverty level.
And who, oh, by the way, are by definition impoverished.
Yes, they are impoverished by definition, and by the amount of money that they make, they're also working.
Well, and what's more, I mean, you've got the mandate, you've got the penalty, and these are folks that if they show up in an emergency room, they don't have Medicaid, they can't get coverage to the exchange, assuming they don't have employer-based coverage. If they're uninsured, and again, there are hundreds of thousands of people in that gap, they are the ones who wind up paying the highest penalty under the ACA. The ones that get hit hardest by the mandate by failing to expand Medicaid are those who can least afford to pay it, or for that matter, least afford to pay for health insurance. And, it just seems to me, you know, look, if we think the mandate is a terrible thing, shouldn't the people in this building be trying to protect Missourians from having to pay the penalty? Yet we have done everything we possibly can to ensure as many Missourians as possible are going to get hit with that penalty by failing to address the Medicaid issue. And we've got to revisit that.
We absolutely do. And I guess my wish is that if we're going to be talking about issues relating to women's health, that's what we would focus on, and not yet another restriction on a procedure that has already been proven to be legal in the state of Missouri and in the United States, and frankly safe. And I know that there's discussion from a lot of folks who are worried about the safety of it, but the reality is, if you look at just the straight-up medical statistics, it's actually an extraordinarily safe procedure.
Well, and there are always inherent risks in any kind of surgical procedure, even the most minor. That said, I think Bill Sponsor agreed with me on this point. Hopefully we can all agree that if it's going to be done, that it be done in a licensed and regulated facility and not the opposite. It's a cliche, but not in the proverbial back alley.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's incredibly important. And so one of the things that I guess my frustration with this debate is that rather than having sort of proactive, preventative discussions about women's health, we almost always focus women's health discussions on restrictions relating to abortion services. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have debates about restrictions on abortion services. I think that is something that is a deeply held belief of many people in this state, and we should have those discussions on this floor. My frustration is that I'm holding a document here that talks about 22 bills that have been filed that only focus on abortion rather than focusing on health care for women.
Right.
And that is frustrating me. And if you will indulge me for just 1 minute.
Gladly.
I want to tell you about a young woman who came to visit me here in the side gallery the other day. I was so moved by her story that when she handed it to me, I asked her if I could hold on to it and share it at the appropriate moment on the Senate floor, because to me, this is the essence of what's wrong with what we're doing relating to health care in Missouri right now. This is a very short story. This is about a woman named Jackie. She lives in Springfield, Missouri. She was born with neurological damage. She graduated from college and found fulfilling work as a caregiver for people with disabilities. Her conditions make full-time work nearly impossible, but she is able to work part-time for minimum wage. She earned $7,000 last year, but one trip to the hospital cost her over $1,000, even after the hospital made several charitable write-offs. As a single woman without children, Jackie is uninsured because she is not eligible for Medicaid. Jackie struggles to get the medications and health care she needs. Jackie has decided to move in with her family in Minnesota now, Senator, where Medicaid expansion has already happened. There she will be able to get health care coverage and the health care she needs. She expects that when she is able to manage her health condition, she will be able to work more and support herself more independently. This is a young woman who was giving back positively in her community in Springfield, Missouri, and doing the best that she can. And because of our failure to address these issues, she's now made the decision to go live with family in Minnesota. And the thing that stinks about this is if she had access to the health care and medications that she needed, she would have been able to stay in Springfield, Missouri, where she would have been able to be a productive tax-paying citizen, giving back to the local economy, helping take care of people with disabilities. When I met this young woman, I was just devastated because she is the woman that falls in that gap. And she's the woman that I want to be talking about. I don't want to be talking about the women who have intensely private, horrible, tough decisions to be making based on their reproductive status and those decisions. I want to be talking about getting access to health care for women to make them productive, healthy members of our society.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, I'm sure she is not the only one.
No, the numbers are quite astonishing. You know, one of the things that I've seen time and time and time again is my clients who sometimes I represent women when their children are removed from their care because of allegations of abuse or neglect. And a lot of times women who have their children removed from their care, they are suffering from extreme mental health issues. The only reason that they have Medicaid at the time that their children are removed from their care is because they have children. Once the children are removed from their care,
they have no Medicaid.
They have no Medicaid, which means they have no health insurance, which means they can't get the mental health help that they need in order to get their children back, which means now the children are stuck in the custody of the state of Missouri, which we're paying for. Those children are stuck there sometimes for life, and the statistics show that those children that are in foster care are more likely to be homeless, go to prison, not finish high school, have teenage pregnancies, all of those things. And it's just this cycle that continues and continues and continues. And had this woman been able to keep her mental health issues under control, had she been able to get the help that she needed, including medications, hospitalization, psychiatric care, her child may have never been removed from her care in the first place. And so now we've got another generation. And the thing that's starting to really, really, really bother me is when I'm representing one of the kids now. So let's focus on this. I'm representing a kid who's in foster care because of they've been removed from their parents' custody. I'm their guardian ad litem. I'm representing their best interests. They've been removed from their parents' custody because of their parents' mental health issues. And then my client is a 15-year-old girl, and all of a sudden she's pregnant, and she has a baby, and she's struggling. And then I see the state have to take that child from her care. Because it's happening now where my clients that are in foster care are having babies that are being put in foster care. And I don't know how to stop that cycle. And I am confident that we have some tools and some ability to address those issues down here, but we just don't focus on them.
Medicaid and support for mental health care and treatment is critical to addressing exactly the kind of scenario that you just talked about. And I'll say I've actually had two or three people come visit me on access to mental health issues in our state just within the last, really just since last night. In fact, it was two or three groups of people, actually. It is a major priority that we as a state, whether it's the population that you've been talking about that you represent or anybody, we just are not getting the job done and need to do better. It starts with the state hospital, but that's one piece of it. Folks have got to have access to quality mental health care in our state. Including those under 138% of poverty, but not just them. It is just It is an area where we simply need to do better. And I am hopeful that now that the state revenue picture has turned around from what we've seen the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, we have many important priorities to fund, including our K through 12 schools, higher education. But in my view, mental health is very close to the top of the list of priorities that we need to address in this state. But I'll say it would help if we were not, if we were not losing or turning down almost $5 million a day because we have an expanded Medicaid in our state. I mean, that would help a whole lot of the kinds of people that you were just talking about. It would help the person that is now a Minnesotan.
Right.
And, you know, and part of the challenge in our state, I mean, we have 8 seats in Congress currently. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we had 10. In the lifetime of many Missourians, we've had double the size of the delegation that we have now. And our state's had population growth, but it hasn't kept pace with the rest of the country. And, you know, I represent St. Louis region, or part of the St. Louis region. And as a region, we have basically the same population today as we did in 1980, almost 35 years ago. And that is only with the better part of 100,000 new Americans coming in from overseas, many of them Bosnian, but a number of people from all over the world have relocated to St. Louis in that time. And without them, we would have experienced population loss in our region over the last 35 years. And I have to say, I think policies or the lack of policies like what you just described on mental health, like Medicaid, going forward as the Affordable Care Act gets implemented, I think is going to make it harder, not easier, for us to compete. That said, I also think we are at a very important moment in time between Medicaid policy, between tax policy, between education policy, where I happen to think, and maybe I'm Pollyannish here, and I failed to include economic development policy, I happen to think that we can get some really good things done on all of these fronts this year and dramatically improve our state's competitive positioning for the years ahead. And I, to tell you the truth, and I, this is an important issue to many Missourians, this is an important issue to many people that I represent, but I want to focus on our state's competitiveness. That's why I'm here. That's why I ran for the House in
right.
Made that decision in 2009. The family that our fence line backed up to, our backyard neighbors, it was a three-income family. The dad had 2 jobs. The mother had 1. They had 2 boys who were, I think, maybe kindergarten and second grade. And the mother lost her teaching job. And in fairness, they had probably agreed to a mortgage contract that, in hindsight, might not have been the best for them.
Sure.
But it was in 2007, when the word subprime was barely entering into the collective lexicon of what was happening in our country at that time. And it was 6 months from the time that she lost her job to the time that they were foreclosed on and out of there. And I remember watching their boys playing in the backyard the day they moved out. They had a swing set. And I couldn't help but wonder if those boys were ever going to have a yard of their own again to call home. And it resonated with me. I heard the story before. When I was 15, my father lost his job. My family lost the home that I grew up in. Parents went bankrupt, turned the keys over to the bank, I'm not here to say that I'm very fortunate and I recognize that in several respects, but the point is what those boys were experiencing
Absolutely.
Resonated with me, and sad fact is that that home was purchased out of foreclosure by a gentleman, and about 3 or 4 years later, he himself was foreclosed on.
Wow.
That home has been foreclosed on twice in this cycle. And it's not the only one in the zip code. And ours is not the only zip code in the region, but there's
right.
been so much of that that's gone on. The reason I share that story, it is critically important for us to maximize our competitiveness as a state and as a region. The cost of failing to do so is evident everywhere, both in small vignettes like the one I just shared and in the bigger picture demographics that I was mentioning a minute ago. But that's why I'm here. That's right. Why I'm here. And don't get me wrong, this bill is an important issue to many Missourians. It really is. But I would, personally, I would prefer be having the discussion about tax policy, about Medicaid, about economic development, about jobs, about education policy.
Right.
And doing what we can to make our state a better place to live and work. This is a very important issue. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. But I would hate to see us fail to address core issues of economic competitiveness for our state at the expense of other issues.
I agree. And, Senator, I heard something interesting the other day from a group that works on RFPs when, a business is looking to relocate to the state of Missouri. And it was an interesting conversation that they had. They...
Three senators standing. Senator from Barry.
Mr. President, I ask for unanimous consent. Mr. President, I would like to lay this bill 519 over.
The bill will be laid on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton, are we staying on the calendar?
Mr. President, we'll go to report standing committees. I have a report.
Send your report forward. Madam Secretary, when the report arrives, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate substitute for Senate Bill Number 694, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate substitute for Senate Bill Number 537, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate substitute for Senate Bill Number 668, begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 17, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 19, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 20, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 21, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 22, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Concurrent Resolution 29, begs leave to report that it has considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Respectfully submitted, Senator Richard Chairman.
Mr. President, objection. The Senate will go to order of business of second reading of Senate bills.
Second reading of Senate bills.
Mr. President, before we do that, would you please send Senate Bill 668 and Senate Bill 537 to the Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight Committee.
Those bills will be moved to that committee.
Senate Bill 775.
Senate Bill 775, an act relating to repealing the death penalty.
Progress and Development, Senate Bill 776.
Senate Bill 776, an act relating to required procedures for the service of warrants.
General laws, Senate Bill 777.
Senate Bill 777, an act relating to sales and use tax exemptions for aircraft.
Ways and Means, Senate Bill 778.
Senate Bill 778, an act relating to firearms.
General laws, Senate Bill 779.
Senate Bill 779, an act relating to state employees.
Governmental accountability and fiscal oversight, Senate Bill 780.
Senate Bill 780, an act relating to the authority of certain constitutional characters, charter cities, to adopt certain types of ordinances.
Jobs, economic development, local government, Senate Bill 781.
Senate Bill 781, an act relating to boards of elections.
Financial, governmental organizations and elections, Senate Bill 782.
Senate Bill 782, an act relating to certification by the American Board for Certification of Teachers' Excellence.
Financial, governmental organizations and elections, Senate Bill 783.
Senate Bill 783, an act relating to the priority of security instruments.
Financial and governmental organizations and elections, Senate Bill 784.
Senate Bill 784, an act relating to anatomical gifts.
Veterans Affairs and Health, Senate Bill 785.
Senate Bill 785, an act relating to temporary boating safety identification cards.
Transportation and Infrastructure, Senate Bill 786.
Senate Bill 786, an act relating to intoxicating liquor manufactured for personal or family use.
Jobs, economic development, and local government, Senate Bill 787.
Senate Bill 787, an act relating to the Capital Sentencing Procedures and Protocols Commission.
Progress and Development, Senate Bill 788.
Senate Bill 788, an act relating to sweepstakes terminal devices.
Commerce. Senate Bill 789.
Senate Bill 789, an act relating to the authority of the Office of State Auditor.
Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight, Senate Bill 790.
Senate Bill 790, an act relating to first-degree murder.
Judiciary, Senate Bill 791.
Senate Bill 791, an act relating to Sunday motorcycle sales.
Commerce, Senate Bill 792.
Senate Bill 792, an act relating to the Crime Victims Compensation Program.
Judiciary, Senate Bill 793.
Senate Bill 793, an act relating to criminal procedure.
Judiciary, Senate Bill 794.
Senate Bill 794, an act relating to irrevocable life insurance trusts.
Financial and governmental organizations and elections, Senate Bill 795.
Senate Bill 795, an act relating to early childhood education.
Education, Senate Bill 796.
Senate Bill 796, an act relating to marriage licenses.
Seniors, Families, and Pensions, Senate Bill 797.
Senate Bill 797, an act relating to voluntary roadside checkpoints.
Judiciary, Senate Bill 798.
Senate Bill 798, an act relating to elementary and secondary education standards.
Education, Senate Bill 799.
Senate Bill 799, an act relating to the introduction of evidence for determining the cost of medical treatment.
Small Business, Senate Bill 800.
Senate Bill 800, an act to authorize the conveyance of property owned by the state in St. Francis County to the City of Farmington.
Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight, Senate Bill 801.
Senate Bill 801, an act relating to the Renewable Energy Standard.
Commerce, Consumer Protection, Energy, and the Environment, Senate Bill 802.
Senate Bill 802, an act relating to child abuse investigations.
Families and Pensions, Senate Bill 803.
Senate Bill 803, an act relating to county building codes.
Jobs, Economic Development, and Local Government, Senate Bill 804.
Senate Bill 804, an act relating to the death penalty.
Progress and Development. Hold on one second.
Senator from Newton. Oh.
All right, Mr. President, would you please refer Senate Bill 694 to the Committee on Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight?
It will so be referred. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Objection. Senator, go to business announcements.
Announcements. Senator from the 15th.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee on Jobs, Economic Development, and Local Government will be meeting right now at 1 o'clock.
Senator from Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have an announcement. It's that your Committee on Agriculture, Food Production, and Natural Resources will be meeting diligently as soon as we can get there at SCR1.
Further announcements? Seeing none, Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business come from the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
Many are the opinion that should prevail. Say aye. To the contrary, say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it.